All right, I think we're going to go ahead and get started. It's about 3:30. Wanted to thank you all for agreeing to participate in this working group or this committee. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Ellen Bolin. I'm the Deputy Commissioner here at MRC. I also bring regards from Steve Bowman. Commissioner Bowman could not make it. He is he's laid up with a foot injury, but I think he would much rather be here than be on crutches. So on that note, the agenda went out, so the first, just to give a quick recap of that, we're going to do introductions, run through some of the changes that have been made, both in legislation as well as the working group that was conducted last fall and summer, and then go into some of the issues we need to work on. So why don't we start with introductions? Becky.
I'm Becky Tubin with the City of Virginia Beach. I'm with the City Attorney's Office.
I'm Russ Perkinson. I'm a riparian property owner in Middlesex County on the lower Rappahannock.
Hey, Gary Erskine. I'm with Savage Ocean Company in Howard Seafood.
I'm Mark Lukenbach. I'm with the Virginia Institute of Marine Science.
I'm Kim Huxley. I'm with Cherrystone Aqua Farms.
Mike Osterling, Executive Director of Shellfish Boroughs of Virginia.
I'm Beverly Lester, more commonly known as Mamaw Lester. I have an oyster farm on the Lynn Haven River.
Tommy Leggett, Chesty Seafood and Aqua Farms, a small scale oyster farmer on the York River, Gulf again.
Andrew Button with the VMRC Oyster Conservation Replenishment Department.
And I'm Ben Stagg, to manage the oyster leasing program for the Marine Resources.
Tony Washington, Chief of the Habitat Management Division here at the Marine Resources Commission.
A few moments of logistics. This is a public meeting. This is a recorded meeting. The documents that we develop are FOIA-able and are available to the public, so something to keep in mind. Again, on logistics, there's water and drinks, and then the restroom is out and around the corner. Any questions or comments or additions to the agenda before we get started? Oh yes, there's also two people who are on the committee that are not here, Jay Ford of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, and Tom Perry of, I remember,
Lightstone. Tom is out of state, said he might be able to conference call in, but he emailed me urgently, said his meeting overlapped. He's looking forward to the event. I don't know
that yet. So quickly going to run through a summary of the Governor's Shellfish Task Force that he pulled together that was led by Secretary Strickler and included many members of this panel as well as a lot of MRC staff. I want to be clear though that this committee is a standalone in its own right. While we are carrying out some of the directives of the working group, it is an independent entity. There are obviously some people that were on both, but this is a new body. So that was pulled together starting last summer. The goal of it was to address some of the user conflicts that have arisen as we increase the amount of shellfish coming out of Virginia waters, an important and critical industry to the area, and trying to balance that with some of the other users in the water. So the group released a report on December 15th. You have a copy of that in your email. I believe there's a few extra copies up here. Wrong, so I'm going to summarize it. Some of the key things that came out was the legislation to be prepared for the 2019 General Assembly on addressing dredging issues in the Lynn Haven that was developed and was enrolled, and I believe that goes into effect July 1. To collaborate on a VIMS-led study on FAV, I believe, Mark, that was enacted?
Yes.
Undergoing?
Yes. There's no directive for them to do it.
Can you use your mic for me, please? Thanks.
It wasn't enacted as a motion for them to do. Rather, it was put in the budget. There's some dollars to address questions related to SAV and aquaculture.
Okay. The MRC was to establish a stakeholder group. Check box on that. There was a few other things, work to establish sort of a separate work group around appraisal. How do we assess the value of land when there is a dredging issue. I think that's largely been resolved in the legislation that passed that specifically dealt with the Lynn Haven, but we can talk about that as a committee if we choose. To exercise authority, the lease application, the electronic means, the MRC tasker, to initiate official rulemaking, including stakeholders on lease renewal exemptions and a beneficial use standard, which is going to be a big part of what we're looking to this committee for, and then legislation. So there was legislation that was developed as a result of this that passed. One piece of legislation, which is particularly relevant today, was Senate Bill 1413 because it had an emergency clause. So once it was signed, it is officially enacted. The other pieces of legislation that were passed will not be enacted until July 1. So SB 1413, introduced by Senator Monty Mason, had a couple of key changes to the way we do business on oyster grounds. And again, these changes were a result of the working group and were supported by all members of the working group. It gave the commission more discretion in applications, transfers, and renewals, and to better account for sort of the public trust doctrine, so Section 1205. So now the commission can reference 1205 when we are determining permit lease applications, transfers, and renewals. Some of the bigger changes is it raised the fees. The previous fee for leases was $25. Those fees have now increased to $300, $500, and $1,000 respectively, depending on the acreage that you are requesting. And those numbers are all in, there was a summary of this legislation that was in the email, and it has all those numbers in it. We also raised the rate of fees for transfers. Previously, they were $5 and $10, then, I think, for transfers. And now they are $300, $500, and $1,000 respectively. We also now have a little bit more authority to review transfers to determine if they are, again, in the public interest and if the lease has been under beneficial use. And then lastly, around renewals, we were tasked with developing a fee structure. So this was the one area where they didn't specify how much. They just said up to $300 for lease renewal fees. And so that is something we are going to be looking to the committee to help us establish. But again, this was emergency enacted. We are already taking steps to address some of this. We have added some questions to our lease application, and then we're also just charging more in fees. So that was a pretty big step.
Do you have any pushback on the new fees?
Not yet.
Good.
Where does the lease fee, where does that money go? What's it used for? And does it reflect the actual time spent in transferring and processing?
So the money goes back to the general fund. It does not come to MRC. The numbers do reflect, but as other members of the work group here that I will also sort of throw this out, the goal of increasing some of the fees, I believe, was also to decrease some of the speculation that's occurring and to try to ensure that the leases that are being applied for are actually being used. So I think it's a combination of trying to decrease speculation as well as charging the actual fee. That's one of the things that will come up when we discuss renewal fees, because that is the fee that has not been set, but we have a cap on that one of $300. Anyone else want to add thoughts to that at either table? Also, for those of you at the table, if you can make sure you speak into your microphone for the recording, that'd be helpful. And down here, too.
To answer your second question, as far as I can tell, no, the fee does not reflect what it costs. The size of the application is not particularly relevant to how long it takes us, or how we review it, or for a transfer.
So it's strictly a deterrent to keep people from speculating or whatever.
I think that was definitely one of the attempts of raising the fees, and particularly raising the larger acreage fee. There was a perception that we've gotten quite a few large lease applications in the last 5 to 10 years that were likely speculative in nature and not really for the purpose of growing shellfish.
Alan, since this was immediate enacted upon immediately. What all have you been charging now for renewal fees? So you haven't processed any between when the legislation was enacted and...
So the legislation, if you look at it in detail, basically said that the agency, through some means, which we're hoping y'all help us, will use the regulatory process to come up with a regulation related to the renewal to include charging a fee up to $300, and it's supposed to be based on our cost, some realistic cost. If it's more than $300, we can't charge more than $300. But we have to do, the legislation contemplates that that particular charge has to be done by regulation, the way I read it. And of course, that's going to take a rulemaking process of talking to y'all, formulating regulatory language, putting it out to the public, having a public hearing, having the commission adopt it. So to answer your question quickly, we're not doing it any differently as far as the fee than we were doing it, and that fee is zero.
Gotcha.
We don't charge any fee at the moment. But we are using the revised law as our guidance on how we look at it.
It was my understanding that the renewal fee was going to be based on your evaluation of what it cost you guys. And that's why there was no value put in. So while you're looking it up for input, we're going to have to throw it back to you and say, what does it cost you in terms of time, whatever?
And I think we understand that. When we start really talking about this, you'll understand why we feel we want your feedback, because this is not a simple task.
We have
mandatory reporting information, but the question is, how do we get that? Do we just pull it ourselves? Do you provide it in the reapplication form? And how do we evaluate that? How quickly can that be done? And what is enough?
One of the problems going to be is that you have some renewals that it's a check mark and you're done. You know, 10 minutes, that's out because you have a history with that person. You know that they've been using it. Someone who has not had the track record, it may take you considerably longer.
Absolutely.
So is it possible to do some sort of a sliding fee? I don't know.
Well, I think we're going to talk about this more.
We're going to need to get your AG involved.
I'm not going to do the introductory part.
The third item on our agenda is to start talking about lease renewals. I just wanted to ask if anybody had any additional questions on the legislation or the work group or our purpose here. Wanted to add anything. So moving on to the third agenda item, we're going to talk about some of the ideas we have around the structure for lease renewals. As Ben said, there's two issues at hand. One that was pretty obvious when we worked on the legislation, which is just how much we charge. Second is the logistics of how and when we do that. And I think there are some timing questions we would really appreciate your input on as well.
So the dilemma is, we gave you a copy in your email, some extra copies over here, of a revised reapplication form. So we've been sending this form out for years. We currently send it out 3 months before the 10 years is coming due. Still, we felt in the past that gave the person plenty of time if they had to go record searching, because they didn't remember what they did 9 years ago. To get it together, we now have some kind of internal debate as to maybe that giving him 3 months is too long, because people get it and put it on the shelf and say, well, I'll do this in a couple of months, and then they don't send it back at all. We haven't changed it much at all what we ask. If you see the form, you'll see we just ask some very basic questions. You know, what percent of the ground did you use, and how many bushels of shell or cultured material did you plant or seed, and how many bushels? We always had bushels for clams and oysters. I did change that to number for clams, because that's a more realistic way that people report clams, is by the number and not the bushel. But those questions are pretty much the same. The second page just quotes the current law, which does have adding the consideration of 1205 of the code, those six factors. And then we have created an internal checklist to help us evaluate the lease once we get this form back.
Under bushel of oysters harvested, an awful lot of the culturists don't deal in bushels. They deal in count.
We could put bushel / number there.
Yeah. If you're going to ask for bushels of our oysters harvested, you need to provide them a conversion. How many culture oysters in a bushel?
We already report. Man started putting it 400 on our monthly report.
What is 400 still the number?
That's
400 still the number?
Yeah.
Okay.
We mandatory reporting already accommodates that, so we can tweak the form to fix that. So in the past we used the law, which none of the verbiage of the law that was already there that says you have to attempt to propagate shellfish. That's one of the requirements. Or plant seed culture material. And then later it says, if there's failure to do that, there's some reasons that we can consider. Doesn't say if you say them, we're necessarily going to renew it. We should consider a number of things. Did the ground historically produce oysters? Is it adjacent to a piece of ground that produced oysters? Did your oysters have MSX and dermo? And other factors, I think it even says other factors, which we don't even know what they are. But now we've also added the six items that are in 1205, some of which don't almost ever apply to a renewal, like wetland impacts. It's kind of rare that a lease would have wetland impacts. And water quality, you could argue that too many oysters. But anyway, but adjacent properties is an important one that's in there now. And other uses of the waterway. So we interpret that to mean, is this area where the lease is being used for something else? Is there a pier in it now? And it didn't used to be a pier in it. Those are all things that we would look to y'all as to, how much weight do we really give those things when we're looking at renewing the lease. If it's part of the lease is no longer realistically usable for the propagation of shellfish, should the whole thing be renewed? Because we want to renew a part of it. So it's not clear here on it's all or nothing, whether we have to renew an entire lease or whether we have the discretion because of the factors, mainly of 1205, that have been added, in my opinion. So we certainly look to this committee for advice on that issue. But our internal checklist, basically, I listed the items in 1205. And initially, when I get one, I just bring up the lease. I look at their mandatory reporting, which is linked directly to my database. I can see it just like that. So time-wise, that's not a big deal. If they have it, I just check the yes box. And if it's a certain amount that seems like it's a lot, I put mandatory reporting every year or every other year. If it's marginal, I might write down on the form, Well, they said they harvested 20 bushels in 1 year and 40 1 year, and that's it. So it's yes, they did have mandatory reporting. User conflicts, I bring up the map then, it has a photograph under it. I look at the lease, I look at what's all around it. Is it adjacent to land? Then yes, it is adjacent to a property. Okay, so the check is yes. Does it look like a conflict? I might write a note there. So I do that with all those questions. And then at the bottom, I have a yes or no. Am I recommending, is my office going to recommend renewal or no? And I have a place to write why I'm saying one or the other. And some of it's clear. All the boxes are no, except mandatory with yes, mandatory reporting. It's pretty obvious I'm going to say yes. And as far as time, ones that are that straightforward take me 10, 15 minutes at the most to look at. It's the ones that the amount of reporting is non-existent, what they put on the form that they harvested a bunch of oysters. That's a real conflict for us here, because somewhere something's wrong.
It's
going to
discussing, right?
Well, we've had internal discussions on how we're going to handle that, and we're still working on it. But yes, I mean, that's, and the question from my office is, what do I write back to the person? Do I say, I'm not renewing it because you said you harvested and you didn't report? Or you said you harvested, you may need to get with mandatory reporting and get in line so these numbers are closer together. That's a problem. And then, of course, the question is, as we're processing this, I have to contact the person back. Time's going by. If they send it in 2 days before their renewal date, you know, what happens with these while they're in limbo? So the way we do it before the law changed, when I got the form back, if I got it back, I could evaluate it, you know, as soon as I got it. Quite often, not the majority, but we get a lot of people who don't send the form back, and the deadline passes. And I go in the system and I say the lease is no return, terminated. And it gets that status. It's like a holding status in the database. I don't actually terminate the lease, but they get a letter that says I did. Because their deadline, they didn't return the form. And I mean, the law is pretty clear. If you don't report anything, what choice do I have? Well, I guess 90% of the time, at least 80% of the time, I get a phone call. And they say, well, I don't think I got the form. And I said, well, we sent it to the same address we just sent this letter. But anyway, and we've sent them the form. And say, okay, maybe you lost it. You're not really terminated, you know. I'll give you another 10 days, 15. Just, I'll email it to you, send it back ASAP. And they do, and they put something on it. And the vast majority of the times I renewed it because I didn't have much criteria not to. So that's a dilemma now. The law is pretty clear. There is a deadline, okay? There is a 10-year renewal. When we send out the form, the new letter clearly states, if you don't send the form back by the deadline, your lease will be terminated. And unless the committee thinks that's a bad idea, I think that's what we have to do. The problem with that is going to be recourse for someone who's been terminated is come before the commission at a hearing and request the commission reconsider, you know, consider, oh, I didn't get the form, you know, I didn't understand, and that's the way it's set up to happen. They can request, because it's a commission decision to terminate their lease.
Can you request that they have the form back to you 15 days prior to the renewal date to give you enough time to process it? Is that legal?
I mean,
is that something that we could do?
I can't answer whether it's legal or not. I think we can set the deadlines whatever we want. You know, the question is, if I'm off for a week, you know,
I don't care about your vacation.
Or whoever's doing this is off for a week. I mean, that's what we're looking for, is advice from the committee. Because that's the problem. For the ones that don't come back at all, that's a real problem. Then you have the ones where they do send it back, and maybe we get it a month in advance. Maybe we get it a day in advance. Either way, we got to evaluate. And perhaps, in our opinion, they don't meet the requirements. They put something on the form, but we just say, you know, this doesn't really meet. It's just too little of effort.
A couple of questions then.
Yeah.
The date, is that in the statute or just, or how's that worded? Or is that in regulation or is it just on a form?
As far as the deadline?
Yeah.
Well, it's like the rent. You know, the law says the rent has to be paid by June 30th. If we don't have a rent in this office by June 30th, your lease is terminated. I view this one as there's a 10-year renewal of the lease, and on the ninth year, 365th day, that's your deadline. And then,
yeah. I mean, if you end up doing a fee regulation, which sounds like you might, and you could specify the idea about the 15 days
right
prior or whatever, a month before, or something like that, and it gives time for at least one last warning letter that goes out, and then if they don't, you know, if they don't respond to that, you know.
Trust me, I'm definitely in favor of a way that we can legally and reasonably do this so that we don't have a flood of people requesting a hearing before the commission, because it'll tie up the commission agenda immensely if this is what happens. Raising the fee is a good issue. So the other problem is, if we send the form, and once a fee is in place, I think we have to, when we send the form, say, when you send it back, you have to send us this fee. This is a fee for us to review it. So we need the fee up front, I think, but here's the dilemma. They don't send the form back. I guess I'm going to evaluate it without one because I'm going to terminate it because I didn't get a form. Well, that doesn't take much time. I didn't get a form. We can eat that cost. But when they do send it back, and we don't believe they met the criteria, and we eventually terminate their lease, we're going to charge them something, and they had to prepay it. They're going to want their money back because I lost my lease. Well, this is for reviewing the lease. You know, I mean, I don't think my idea is you can't, this is not refundable.
Well, it's just like a lease application fee.
Right.
If you don't get your lease, you don't get the application fee back.
And that's been our policy. But curiously enough, the law doesn't really say that. Even the application fee is not refundable, and it doesn't say that in the code. We've always treated it that way. So back to what we charge, you're right. I mean, we have to tell you what we think the amount of time is. But I can tell you that if we have to do a really extensive review of one because what they sent back was marginal, and we write back and say, you know, you said you put a bunch of shell on it, you don't show any harvest in mandatory reporting, do you have any records to show you actually bought shell? And, you know, and this can be a back and forth thing for a while, maybe, for go on for weeks, you know, while we're trying to get that information. Those are going to cost more than $300, I can tell you that. So, I mean, they get... So one thing we've internally talked about is just throwing out to y'all a straw man is, you know, should we have start out with two fees? You know, one is the minimal amount of review is, you know, $100 or whatever. And then anything that really requires a lot of work by the agency is something else, $200, $300. Problem is, we won't know that until they send it in. We won't know that they qualify for the $100 fee. I mean, I can look at AJ and say, when Bevin sends me one, I'm pretty sure it's going to be approved, but, and I understand what you said earlier, but I don't think that's the way we can do business here. We have to have some criteria, and we can't say, just because I know Bevins, or just because I know Tommy, and I know he's a legitimate guy, if his numbers aren't on the form, I don't see how we renew it, or at least we question it.
So Ben, is there a way to, you said it has to be tied to your actual cost. Does it have to be actual cost per application, or can you sort of track your overall costs over several months and then kind of figure out an average?
I think we could do an average. It still makes me ask, how do I know what the person's supposed to send in with the form if I have no idea what they're going to put on the form?
But I think for some people would probably require less cost than the average. And what I'm saying is everybody has to pay whatever that average amount is, and it's non-refundable.
Right.
And that becomes the fee, and it becomes less paperwork and tracking. And, you know, I mean, when you end up having to owe somebody back something, then it becomes almost a fiduciary duty.
Oh, yeah.
To
we really don't.
Share those funds.
Yeah, the government, we don't like to do that because refunding money is just a lot of rigmarole, and it costs us more to refund it than
right.
We take in sometimes.
So it seems like if you could figure out what the average cost is, by and large, then and have one fee, and I would recommend setting a application deadline of at least 30 days ahead of time. This is a 10-year lease, so, you know, maybe 1 year notice ahead of time to say, reminder, next year is your, you know, the end of your lease, and so they're kind of on notice for up till then, and then get them up to that 30 days, because I think it cuts them short. It cuts everybody short, especially you. How do you do a thorough investigation
right.
if you've only got 1 day to do it?
Right. Well, we Sending them a notice is fine a year away. They won't forget that by the time they think of it. But if you still sent the notice 3 months in advance and said it has to be back in 2 months, still a month ahead, that would give us 30 days to do whatever it is you got to do, contact them back.
I would think more like 60, but anyway, that's from my experience before I retired from the state to another agency. We would ask for, we put in regulation, they'd have to give it to us 60 days prior for reapplication for like a certification as a nutrient management planner, something of that nature that had a 3-year life. It was the certificate's length of time. It was valid for shorter than what you're talking about here, but we asked more than 60 days or required that, and we could get them and see what the deal was with it. If somebody didn't respond, yeah, we did give them one last chance to do it before we took action to terminate their certification. So, you know, something like that at least gives you some time to work with, and then you don't have it all going before the commission.
The other issue here, that's a good idea. The other issue here is what the law said. The law said we have to create a regulation, and it certainly talks about the money. And we have to have some criteria, too. And we have 1205, and we have the law, which has must attempt to propagate shellfish or plant. But it's still not very quantifiable. It's still sort of arbitrary. What is it? I'll let Andrew discuss what might be a reasonable expectation of use per acre. But that's something that could be in the regulation, the criteria related to administering this law and the fee, or it could just be the fee and we create a guidance document of some sort internally here with certainly y'all's input that kind of helps us with a guidance document on, just like we have a guidance document for joint permit applications, you know, what some of the criteria would be.
Industry is going to want to know how you came up with the figure, whatever the figure, because the law that was passed says that the fee is based on the expense that you incur during the renewal. So if it's simply we averaged everything and the average fee is $125, that's fine. But there has to be some explanation about how you came up with that figure.
I think if we did what Becky said, that's what we do with applications.
Yeah.
The code says that's the one fee in the code that's not set in the code. It's what we charge to survey the application. Not the application fee, but to survey it. And it's that. We get to set that, and you know, to be set on what our costs are. So every number of years, I take all of our project reports, I add them all, the number of hours the guy spent on every single project, new application. I divide it by the number of applications. I get all the overhead costs, their salaries, and it's just a simple math exercise. And I come up with, so what is our average cost to do a survey? Some cost us $2,000, some cost us $300, because we do them really quickly. And that's how we set the current fee. So we can certainly do that with the reapplications.
You could set a time period to reevaluate the average, you know, every 3 or 5 years or something, just to make sure. And it may be the first year based on prior, you know, because of the new law, you may find that there's a lot less of them that are tricky. You know, people decide not to apply when they realize there's new standards and higher fees. So it may go down over time.
I think it will go down over time. I think it'll be high first year because if we turn down anybody, yeah, they're gonna contest it. And do we factor in all the time we spend at the commission meeting if they contest it? Is that part of it, or is that just a separate action after we turn them down? I think it is, but so just try to stop talking. But just a little bit more on if we get one back and it's questionable, you know. And let's use the shell example. They say they planted a bunch of shell. But they don't have any receipts. And they write back and they say, well, I didn't know I was supposed to save all these because you changed the law on me, you know. Well, not really. We didn't really exactly change the criteria. But anyway, I tell you, if you go under my ground and you check it, you will see
You know, there's shell everywhere. And there's probably some orchards on it. You know, I just can't get them to market size. Well, if we go out in the field and check these, you know, it's $300 plus. I mean, all just like that. I mean, you know it is. So those few will drive costs way up. The simple ones where they got lots of mandatory reporting, they've reported that they planted shell and culch, brought in seed, brought James River seed, and they brought, you know, those won't take much time at all, particularly if they provide any documentation. And we'll have the mandatory reporting. I've already had some since the law changed that were both directions. I had some that said they harvested a bunch and they had no mandatory reporting. And then I had some that said, you know, the opposite. They'd have put down very little harvest. I went to mandatory reporting and they had a bunch. And I was like, really? You're getting your nice lease renewed. You think you'd at least put down pretty close to accurate information. Now I've had some that are spot on, amazingly, already. And they have right much harvest, but their numbers were real close.
AJ?
So, I guess I was the one that spoke at the work group quite a bit about renewal fees in the sense that we talked about the application fee going up, we talked about transfers going up, we talked about renewal fee. Well, there is no renewal fee. We now are implementing a renewal fee.
Right.
So it's an additional cost to the industry. So significantly, the application fee went up. Significantly, the transfer fee went up. And my concern was we're putting another fee on industry, one that does not currently exist back then. So the question was, $300 over 10 years is a very small amount to pay. I agree. If you have multiple leases renewing at the same time, it might not be a small fee to pay. So the transfer application as it was, you could list multiple leases to transfer at one time. Will this renewal process encompass multiple renewals on one lease, on one application? Or is this a single lease renewal?
Don't read the law that we can do that. Now, in the past, we used to allow multiple transfers on the same transfer form because really it was just a paperwork exercise of getting ownership from one person to another. There was no review of it. We didn't decide whether it was a good idea to transfer it. You had it. You have the right to transfer it. Now we have the right to look at a transfer and say, maybe we're not going to transfer it because, one, you didn't do anything with it for 8 years. And the new person doesn't have a good plan either. And that, I don't think there's any other way to read the transfer law but one lease. One lease per transfer. So if you wanted to transfer, if you all your leases into a company name, and it was 10 leases, and they were all over 25 acres, that's $10,000 to transfer those leases. But I think we have to evaluate each lease under the law. Was it used? There is the caveat in the law that says, well, it's adjacent to a lease, you know, the whole argument of a buffer lease, or, you know, I don't use this one much, but I use this one a lot and it's productive, and I might use this one in the future. I mean, that's in the law already. It says adjacent to or historically produced oysters, maybe 20 years ago, and you just haven't had success on it. Those are sort of in the code. So you do get some credit for other leases that might be impacting it, but I don't see how we can evaluate multiple leases for one fee unless somebody else.
Well, that's where I think I'm headed with, you know, there are a lot of layers to the renewal process. As Ellen said, this is maybe a complicated issue. There's the fee structure side of it, but then there's the other motivation that we had at the work group, which was looking at some of these renewals where people are renewing a lease with no intention of propagating shellfish. We're talking about commercial leases here that must be, by law, productive. Now, brings in the question of productivity standards, brings in the question of use plans, all these things that we discussed. I just want us to, I guess, as we move forward in this, which we have to, renewal fee, I get it, just be aware that making this overly complicated for industry can be problematic. And, you know, there's the cost piece. I see that, you know, over here. There's also making this thing really complicated where we talked about seed areas, where there are nurseries, and not going to have productivity on those areas. Well, I should say, you're not going to have harvest, mandatory harvest records. So there's a lot of layers to the discussion, and I just want us to be fully aware as we talk about renewals that it's not just as simple as, hey, it's an average fee, and this is what we're going to do. And we'll look at it and say...
Trust me, I've already internally here said, you know, this is nuanced like you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
So it's good that you raised commercial and productive. So what do we do with the one person, the guy had one lease, and he's not commercial. But he does harvest a few oysters every year for, you know, a few bushels for his personal use. Do we take his lease away from him? I don't...
One second, Mark. We have a new addition. Jay, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, Jay Ford, Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Extremely late.
Jay, just to let you know, this is a public meeting. It is being recorded.
Excellent.
Mark.
Well, I'm glad AJ brought this up, but I think it's probably time to get some of these things on the table to separate them and actually deal with it. I haven't heard anybody say anything that's workable other than following the guidelines that you've got to get some sort of average. And the average, you might not even be able to get the average because some of the big ones may make it over 300. It's extra work for industry. It's possible you can't do refunds. You don't know what it's going to cost you ahead of time. You got to do the computation of an average. I think the tougher things we have to work out are going through some of the other aspects, whether or not it's in regulation or whether it's in guidance. AJ mentioned one of them, and I think it's a really important one. The categories on the form, I think, need to be robust enough to account for all the various things that a truly, no question, productive aquaculture industry could be doing with the lease. You know, they could be specifically using an area as a feed area at some point. So they show no harvest, but they have nursery their seed there for a while.
I think the cherry's about that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. And so that's gotta be clear. I think, and it's a good thing you've got enough people from the industry here to help identify this. One of the tougher ones is how do you evaluate the size of the lease versus the amount of activity? You gotta accommodate the fact that real legitimate working members of the industry rotate where their crops are, where they're actually planting. They've got different uses at different times of the year, at different times in the growth cycle. You gotta accommodate all of that, but somebody who can legitimately show you a receipt for 100 bushels of shell over 10 years and a little bit of harvest is not planting and propagating shellfish. That's counter to the law that you're supposed to be planting and propagating shellfish. And I mean, at some level, if you don't have that as part of your overall portfolio, again, given the nuances that happen in the industry that's really doing it, and those that are flat out just paying that fee so that they've got exclusive right to harvest the modest number of oysters that are on there. In much of the bay, when you're talking bigger subtidal areas, that's an area where, you know, in recent years, folks have been doing this just so they can get a dredge on them. But at the work group, there was a lot of discussion, particularly out of from Rob Blossom, about what has been very traditional on the seaside of the Eastern Shore, which is, and maybe some of the creeks of the Eastern Shore, particularly the seaside, is folks are not really planting and propagating anything. They've been in the family for a long time. They're able to go pick up, a few bushels of oysters and use it for their personal use. That stuff can't really now be used for other things, either expanding the real industry or not. So that's where to go with something like that. That's that traditional, as opposed to this new rush of taking out a VC and put a dredge on it. So we really need to nail those down.
Mike and Jay?
That brings up a question I had in when you were explaining how you evaluate use. How do you evaluate somebody who has had a lease for 10 years and for the first 8.5 years they get squat? And they go, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to renew my lease in another year, and they throw some stuff down. In other words, I know that the code does not allow you to do that type of subjective evaluation, but do you take that into account when someone puts in for a renewal and they've had this 1 acre ground or 5 acre ground or whatever, and they do exactly what Mark said? In the ninth year, they put 100 bushels of shell down and said, I shelled it.
So I'm going to let Ben answer sort of the nitty-gritty of that, but I think as we talk about this, you guys are getting a sense of some of the internal conversations we've had where we can go around the table and do a what if. And that's created some real challenges in terms of how can we set these guidelines or these regulations. We are, to clarify, we are required by law to set a regulation on fees specifically. In terms of renewal criteria, that was more a directive from the work group. We can decide if we want to do a regulation and guidelines, two regulations. But I would urge the committee to try to think of what I refer to as the 80-20 rule, which is as we write these regulations and as we write these guidelines, we're really trying to capture about 80% of the problem, because we're always going to have outliers. We're always going to have weird ones, and that's where we look at the expertise of staff and also the commission. At the top of one of the memos, I wanted to clarify that people can request a hearing to the commission if we do deny their transfer or renewal. But again, this just reflects a lot of the conversations we've had. These are not easy things, and there are going to be a lot of different cases. But again, trying to capture maybe even 75%, 75% of the scenarios, and I think that's where the average and the median comes in. Jay, did you want to say something?
I'm coming in late, but it struck me that we've got a lot of questions around this idea of how you make the determination on whether or not you're going to allow a transfer or a renewal. And to me, that was tied back into our conversation from last year around the idea of beneficial use and fleshing that out. And it sort of feels like we're putting, I can't really tell you what I think you should charge for it until I know how you're making that determination. And so I feel like maybe the conversation's a little out of order. Like, we should be nailing down the beneficial use component first and deciding what that line is going to look like in the decision-making process for a change for a renewal before we talk about what that fee is going to be.
Let me jump in real quick to answer your question, and then I'm going to address what he said. I think you're right. The beneficial use was the elephant in the room that we did not even mention when we started this. And these kind of go hand in hand. You're right. The current law and the way I've been doing it, right or wrong,
anything in 10 years,
the key language in the law to me is that has significant production of oysters or clams or reasonable plantings of oysters, clams, or cults during any portion of the 10-year period. So if they go gangbusters the last year and a half, I've been renewing. Okay, that's what I've been doing. I'm wondering now if I should do that in the future based on some additional factors of 1205 and an opinion from the work group last year that we need to really look at these a little more strictly. My problem is I got to have some criteria, and beneficial use plays right into that. So.
Beverly, AJ, Austin, and I think maybe Kim had her hand up.
Listening to the conversation, Bev Ledford, a lot of things come to mind that apply to the leases that we have. One is that we have conditional leases where we can only work that harvest from those leases when we don't have an inch of rain in 24 hours. And last year we had almost 100 days of an inch of rain in 24 hours. So a third of the time we weren't allowed to harvest off. And this is at least it's only 3 acres, and that's where a lot of the aquaculture with the structures on the bottom that are not 12 inches are being used. We also have, just like any other farmer, and we've been designated a farm by the Department of Agriculture, we have a farm number, we are a farm. We do what has been alluded to here, we rotate crops. You know, we rotate seeds versus bottom oysters that are growing on the bottom with shell and so forth. And we've worked with the Department of Agriculture to plant shells and successfully have done a lot of that because we had leases that didn't have any oysters on them when we leased it. There were no oysters to harvest. It's kind of hard to harvest when there's no oysters on the bottom. So we had to grow oysters in order to accommodate that. We have one small lease that we use entirely for educational purposes. All we do is take students out there. They have their own area. They plant oysters that have been shells that have been put in bags. They mark their they come back in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months during the school year and take a look at how their oysters are growing. And it's nothing but because we want children and young people to learn about being watermen and growing seafood and keeping the river clean and all those other good things. So that lease is just for educational purposes. Very small, but we don't harvest anything off there at all. Don't intend to right now because these oysters belong to the kids from the various high schools and the area, and so that's another. Also, I want to mention, I made a list of a bunch of stuff. So I'm just running down some variables that you need to think about when you look at beneficial use. We believe that, you know, the aquaculture creates sustainable seafood so that we're trying to have enough product to supply our restaurants on a rotating basis. You know, we're not trying to grow more than, if you let them, particularly with aquaculture, my experience has been their survival rates after about 3 or 4 years are not that great. Most of you would agree with me that aquaculture oysters don't live as long as wild oysters, yeah? So you have to be careful to rotate your crops. I don't think there's a survey necessary. I really don't think people need to resurvey some of these areas because they were surveyed. And we have to keep the white markers out there. They're still there. They can't be moved. That seems to me a waste of resources to resurvey, but I could be wrong about that. I think that the possibility that you could use certain leases more in the early stages, depending on how much equipment you have. And if you're starting out as a farmer, which we did a decade ago, you didn't have enough. You could only buy so much equipment every year just because you didn't have the resources. So it makes sense to me that some leases might not be really active up until the fifth or sixth year because you're trying to acquire enough gear to work them. Those are just some points. I think that my biggest concern is that I don't think it should be the subjective view of one staff person whether or not a lease should be renewed. I think it should be some criteria that doesn't make you mark a box that says, what do you plan to do on this lease? And if it is the beneficial or the propagation of shellfish and the beneficial use of shellfish for that particular body of water, then it should be approved. As simple as that. If your plan is to use it for the right reason, and you can show that you've been doing it for the right reason, I think all this nitpicking is just nitpicking. You know, whether it's been 60 bushels or 2 years, or, you know, are you growing oysters? That should be it.
There's a couple other hands up, I think AJ and then Russ and then Ken.
Well, and therein lies the issue, is the subjectivity of this and the productivity standard, which we talked at length about before. I think it's dangerous. I'm not sure we need to get into productivity. I mean, what you mentioned before was somebody that just had one lease, maybe two leases, and they put out some shell. Who's to say that's not beneficial? I'm not.
Well,
I mean,
why I'm asking these questions.
Right. So the question becomes, you know, how are we renewing leases for the right reason? I'll go back to something that we said. I don't mean to go back, but I'll go back to the work group and the comment that was made. There was a lot of years that people had leases, and it wasn't very popular to have leases, and they weren't productive. And these companies stayed in it for decades, literally, and kept those leases going and paid lease fees and so on. And then they made them productive. And that was at the benefit of the state. I mean, that was the public trust card. Everybody had a stake in that, even though it was on industry that maintained the leases and did what they could. So I think if we're coming to putting something on paper that is subjective and it's a standard, it's a productivity standard, you must produce whatever it is per acre, however we're going to do it. I think you're going to find a lot of people up at this podium in front of this commission that say, I have a problem because I had these leases for a number of years and it was free to you all because I was the one, my business, my family did this and they maintained these leases. So I think if we're talking about, you know, coming up with a standard, a fee is something that we can do that, and the fee is going to be in the code. But I suggest we look strongly at guidance where we can change the guidance. We can say beneficial use is a number of different things. Maybe we give some examples of beneficial use, sanctuaries and so on. But when I think when we start putting something down that is staff is reviewing it and looking at is it this box, or this box, then we're gonna start to have some problems, I think. So that doesn't help for getting, help to get renewals out of the hands of people that are not using them for the right reasons. I get that. But again, we might not be at that 75 or 80% standard. We might start a lot less than that. Russ?
Thank you. I'll disagree with some of the comments I've heard earlier, but I agree with a fair amount of what I just heard recently from AJ. We've got in my area, we've got a lot of small leaseholders. These are small producers. Some are very close, operate very close to my property and have leases of these small producers, and I haven't had any real problem with them. You know, we know who the people are, and they come to us if they want permission to run a, you know, permit for a crab run. They want to run on mean low water or something like that. So I've seen, you know, these are not intensive producers, the ones I'm talking about, in it, but I have seen them harvest, and so, you know, there is some activity. And I don't know that that's a bad thing. It doesn't create, you know, it's a riparian landowner, and trying to represent that view here, it hadn't really caused me really any adverse impacts what they're doing. They are operating. And I guess the second thought I would have on this has to do with the beneficial use. And I heard some comments earlier before the last couple speakers who talked about, you know, it seemed like harvest had to be the driving force. And I disagree with that because let's say I want to plant some oysters, you know, obtain some lease and plant some oysters just because I think it's the right thing to do. You know, maybe my son might harvest a few of them for his own use, but I just think it's the right thing to do. And I would plant a diploid oyster so they would reproduce because I think that's the right thing to do. So I think there's other, as was pointed out, there's other reasons people grow oysters that can be beneficial uses in it. You know, to consider that it shouldn't just be productivity or output. You know, granted, I wouldn't mind providing some record that I actually seeded some of this area or whatnot. I think that's fair for these small producers in my area. You know, I'm sure they have records that they seeded or some growing cages, actually, but you know, they've got some records there. So I guess that's what I'd point out is I think, you know, if you look at the overall scope of the thing as far as beneficial uses and trying to weigh that against impacts the industry causes, you know, you've got to look at both sides of that coin and realize, you know, oysters can be beneficial in different ways or they can have impacts in different ways and to different degrees. So I'd ask, do we try to be mindful of that, and maybe some of these small producers, if they are using reproductive oysters, maybe take some pressure off the public grounds as far as allowing reproduction. You know, if they don't, let's say they don't harvest 100% of what they have, they, you know, they tong it or whatever, and they don't get 100% out of it as to what's growing there, maybe that's a good thing in it because there's something left to reproduce. Thanks.
Okay, Mike, then Mark.
Okay. I guess I really just have a question. We're picking up on a conversation many of us had last year in detail. Some of us weren't part of that conversation. I feel like we're a little bit all over the place right now because, you know, we beat this thing to death in terms of making sure that Ecolot from the Bay Foundation, all we do is want to put out oysters and then have people not touch them. So we're on board. But my question is the beneficial use term, that's running through a separate process, correct? You all, were that not yet decided? Because my understanding from the work group last year was the agency felt they had authority to develop this through rulemaking. That's why we didn't need it in the legislation. Are you envisioning us having that conversation? Or are you going to run this thing elsewhere?
So the other disclaimer that was made at the top of the conversation is that while we are informed by what the work group did, this is a standalone body with its own mission, and we can use some of those discussions, but there are new faces and old faces and want to try to keep the conversation current, but we can talk about some of the topics that came up there. So the tricky thing is that, you know, we have one requirement by law that was enacted, and then we have other things that were strongly suggested by the governor's task force to do. One of that is to develop, in the working group report, it does say regulation, a regulation on renewal criteria. The other one also says a regulation around beneficial use. To give a quick snapshot for those of you who weren't in the working group, beneficial use and the beneficial use standard came up a lot. It was part of basically every conversation, and how do we define what's the appropriate use of a lease. And as Jay said, the conclusion we came to was that within the existing regulations and codes, MRC has the authority to develop regulations to that effect. That is not a regulation we would develop solely in-house. We would want to and are planning on talking to the committee about. The reason why we started with the lease renewal fee is because that was what we were, the one thing we have to do above everything else. It does feel a little chicken or the egg in terms of how do you figure out a fee, how do you figure out criteria if you don't figure out what a beneficial use is. But long answer to a short question of yes, our thinking is we will likely look into a regulation or a guideline around beneficial use because that was the recommendation from the working group. Mike?
I oppose production standards. Because it is such a slippery slope, because you've got some guys that are outstanding farmers and they can get every last oyster off the ground. You've got other guys that aren't as conscientious. And then Bev gave you an example of what I consider a totally appropriate beneficial use for the education. And you're not going to get any metrics off of that. But that, to me, is a beneficial use. So I think we need to stay away from saying you need to produce X number of bushels per acre, because it's not going to work. It's just not going to work. Beneficial use has to have a lot of different applications. There's a lot of different things that people do on their ground that are beneficial. Putting animals out just to filter water is beneficial. Teaching high school kids how to grow oysters is beneficial. So I don't like the idea of a production standard.
Okay. Mark?
I'm going to be quick because I have to first give apologies that I have a drop dead departure time of 4 minutes ago. I'm sorry. I have a conflict. It's our first meeting, so maybe it makes sense that we're all over the place. But we did a retread on things. I think a path forward on at least calculating what a fee is going to be is pretty obvious of how you need to try that. See what, at least do the calculation and see where things land. Secondly, yes, for those who weren't involved in it, the use is pretty easy to make be broader than production. The challenge is, however, that there are real problems out there with places leased that are tied up, that are not being used or being used inappropriately. The challenge isn't to weed out a single legitimate use or legitimate member of industry, but we got to come up with standards that provide some guidance, and personally I think guidance would be better than regulation. It's more nimble, at least until you've done it long enough to feel like the guidance is good enough. But what we really need to do is come up with the guidance that fixes a good percent of the problem issues out there. There's a lot of bottom tied up, either being used not at all or inappropriately, and it is stymieing the industry. So if we just keep ourselves focused, we'll thread that needle the right way, so that you're not renewing leases that have been families and they just didn't, you know, they're using them for different reasons. You're renewing leases that aren't being used. I mean, sanctuaries are great use, and educational programs are great. They all fit the original law and all of this. There's nothing that says that planting and propagating shellfish says that they have to harvest shellfish. So, I mean, that part's pretty straightforward. And maybe if we come next time and sort of think about what are the specific things we could recommend that would be useful tools for VMRC to be able to weed out the ones that nobody up here wants to see them. I mean, we kind of all got positions staked out what we don't want to see, but let's figure out where we can land with some recommendations. Does it make sense to get recommendations from us? Because you don't want to use any guidance that's going to get in the way of legitimate operating industry. But you don't want to be as hands tied as you've been in the past, in which everybody gets it. Just about everybody gets it. We can fix that problem.
And I'm sorry, Juan, as you're leaving, you remember, I know we had a survey that was discussed about the breakdown of use, and we were really focused on some of those leases that there was no shell being applied. They were kind of just waiting for.
Some of the stuff that Jim West made up.
Yeah. Is there any way that can be made available to folks?
I think the one member that report's already been turned in to the CGM. I don't know the status of the Coastal America program.
Current grant?
Well, they're in year two or three or something. Yeah, but there's a year one report. I don't know which of those numbers are in. I'll try to find that. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
I'm unable to
yeah.
Okay.
Can
I answer?
Of course.
How many leases are there right now total?
About 5,400.
So if each one of those is renewed every 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
You're doing, I'm just.
Say 5,200, that includes your Rock Area.
How many of those are you doing a year?
On average, you do about 30 a month.
So you're doing about 360 a year. Just say 300 to 400, somewhere in that range.
Yep.
Okay. So if you charge them the maximum amount, and there were 400 of them, that's only $12,000, right? Is my math wrong?
I think that's right.
It's not anywhere near what it could
be. Yeah,
$120,000?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you did 400, you charged them $300 a piece, and it was $120,000, you know, you would either know, yes, that would cover the cost, or no, it wouldn't. You know what I'm saying? You know, I don't know how you would do that, but if you want to get down to the basics of it, you're doing so many a year, and it's easy to kind of average out. And so someone said earlier, average out what the cost is and come up with a figure, and then at the year two, you assess whether or not that was close enough to cover the cost and make adjustments. This is not in cement, right? You can change.
Correct. And I think that's something to remember going forward on this and other guidelines, is that these will evolve. That's the perk of doing this not in code but in regulations and guidelines, is we can have these conversations and we can learn and evolve as we need. We can do adaptive management, Mike.
If you recall, when we were discussing renewal fees at the Secretary's work group, there was some pushback for having the renewal fee at $300. Some industry people felt that was a little excessive. and that was the reason, that was the reason the language was put in, that it would reflect your cost, but not more than $300. I think that some people left the secretary's work group thinking that the renewal fee was going to be considerably less than $300. So I think that if we came forward now and said $300, you're going to have some pushback from some people that attended that work group and said, hey, this is not what we agreed to.
Well, I think what I'm looking at now is, you're right about my math, it's somewhere between $40,000 and $120,000. That's what the total would be, somewhere between $40,000 and $120,000. So if you come back to the committee with an estimation of, you know, what are the costs, that would give us some idea.
Which is going to the general fund.
Right. Yeah. Again, to be clear, this money does not, like, we're not
reflecting your cost.
Yeah, we're not trying to buy new cars. So, right.
You can put it at 120, but unless you go get an appropriation back to VMRC for that, it's not actually going to your cost.
I'm not going to stack the costs higher than they are, because
money doesn't come back.
As
we go back and try to look at some of our calculations and what numbers we can pull, I'm trying to get a sense from the committee, is the inclination to do sort of an average fee across the board, or to do sort of more of a tier fee, which is what Ben threw out in the beginning of, if you, something as a bright line of, if you can attach a mandatory reporting report, $100. If not, different category. I'm looking at, I'm getting looks from AJ and Mike. I just kind of gauge where the sense of the committee is, so when we go do our homework, we bring back what the committee is, and I'll try to figure out maybe a tiered approach is needed. Anybody's ready? Okay.
So I think what we clearly said was mandatory reporting is not going to do it.
Okay.
Because Beverly gave a great example of ground that's not a mandatory report. Secondly, companies, industry that is renewing a number of leases at the same time,
mm-hmm.
could get a little costly if it's all $300. If it's $300 per lease, that could get pretty expensive at the time of renewal for several leases. And I don't think, Ben, you might be able to tell me, that might not be uncommon that people renew several leases at the same time.
Sometimes they transferred into company names all at the same time. Mm-hmm. Conway Brown, when he died, the vast majority of it was transferred to his grandson, Wyndham Fields.
Mm-hmm.
And he paid the current fee for a transfer. We looked at that the other day. It probably would cost him almost $100,000 to transfer all the ground they had, because they had a lot of leases. Conway and his other companies had well over 3,000 acres.
So the benefit to what I think the work group worked on was to discourage transfers prior to renewal.
Right.
And so therefore, the renewal, which again goes to the general fund, doesn't come back to your cost, shouldn't be at the $300, in my opinion.
Tommy?
The only thing I've got is I'm starting to afford it, a commercial producer. I mean, that's all I've got. I've got 2-3 leases of my own. I'm using leases that people are letting me use,
mm-hmm.
but they're not getting harvest on. And so when these people renew their lease, what are they supposed to do? Should I be giving them numbers saying this is all part of Tommy Leggett's oyster farm? He produces X number of bushels or thousands of oysters a year.
I think your form at the bottom, big black letters, explain additional effort or explain the reason for no significant production. The best can put down, I hope, high school training exercise.
Absolutely.
Your guys can say, Tommy Leggett has been growing on these grounds.
That's what I do.
Yeah.
Well, but how long does it take for you to renew that? Is that $100 worth? I mean, as a tier approach, I think is something we need.
Well, that's why we brought it to you. I wasn't necessarily promoting the tier approach. We had an internal discussion, and that was the first thing we said. Well, first, we have to figure out what it really costs to do different scenarios, but there are a lot of scenarios, so one size may not fit all here. And you're right, if you
10 leases all come up at the same time, and they're all, you know, they're all going to be $300 a piece. But they're all productive, and you can show it. You know, should you have to pay $300? You know, I can definitely see the argument why you shouldn't. Or you use it for some, you know, some other use. I've always considered those things, okay? Yeah. You know, if you put comments, that's the reason the comment thing is down there. Please explain to me what you did or why you didn't do. That's what the code says. Yeah.
And before we get to rest, I mean, it's also worth noting that now when we renew, we look at 1205, which lists a variety of things for public trust, other reasonable and permissible uses, marine and fisheries resources of the Commonwealth. You're trying to train new watermen, that's a marine fisheries resource. So we are trying to balance sort of the possible thing, right? We don't want to be too subjective, but we want to have some objectivity so it's not just one person making decisions. We want to have flexibility for good actors, but have bright lines for bad actors. Like, this is sort of the push and the pull, and so we're trying to find that middle ground. But I mean, it comes from a place of wanting to ensure that the leases are used in a beneficial use, and we're trying to figure out what the best way forward is for that. Russ and then Mike.
Okay, I wasn't going to weigh in on the lease figure for the renewals, but I will. I think, again, I don't want to, I'd hate for us to run the small producer out of business with it. So what I'd suggest is calculate your average cost for an average lease. And I heard clearly what you said about it takes almost as much time to do an evaluation on a 5-acre lease as a 250-acre one. I think come up with an average cost and then let this committee look at trying to tier something based on the scale of operation, because it wouldn't make sense for somebody with 5 acres to pay $300 and somebody with 250 acres to pay $300. So I think, you know, looking at the code, it says such fees shall reflect the cost of the commission to process them. Well, that could be interpreted, that could cover your cost in total across all of them. And if you have we'd have to have some data on how many leases are in different size categories, so we work a figure out that covers your cost in total based on that. And that's all I'll say about that. I'll come back to the things I wanted to ask earlier. On your reassignment form, it talks about percentage of lease use. It's just for my understanding purposes. That means, like, let's say 75%, I checked that. Does that mean I used 75% of that total lease area at some point during the 10 years? You know, I could have used, some of it some years and other area, but that's not an average per year, right? That's like anything that was done over that whole 10-year lease period. And then I've got to follow up with that, and I'll shut up.
I would say yes.
Okay.
Over the whole 10 years, understanding you may rotate around, but if you use 75%, any other cumulative.
Okay.
Some part of it, you use 75%. And there was 25 you just didn't use.
Yep.
I would renew one of those, by the way. 75% is a lot. I get a lot of people who say 50 and 25%. But they have harvest and it's pieces of ground that you don't want to throw your money into because it's not worth it.
The other question that's, I noticed in the materials we got, some of the description and write-up about some of the things in the summary of the code, it was very good. I'm not sure it was in there, the email, but somebody, I think Ben mentioned this internal checklist. And the stuff we got beforehand said you were going to seek input on that or what the committee thought ought to be considered in the internal checklist. So how would you like that input? Or, I mean, it's an internal checklist. Are we going to get to see what's in use now? Or do you just want ideas eventually, not today? I don't have them today myself.
The internal checklist is not a secret, okay? We did figure we had to limit to some degree how much information we overwhelmed you with in the first meeting.
That'll be later then.
But,
I'm open to providing it to you.
It's pretty simple. It's not a secret.
Doesn't have to be now. I'm just wondering at some point.
Mike and AJ?
couple questions or comments. First, have you had past issues with people who had problems getting a renewal, or has the past been a little less stringent than what the work group now has put on you?
I'd say number two is more correct.
Right.
We have on occasion, I mean, we didn't turn down many leases in the past. Most people put something on the form, and you know, I'm a small department. It's me and Hank Badger that are looking at all of these, and we got a lot of other things to do, and if you put down something that looks halfway reasonable on the form, you know, we just spend a whole lot of time looking at it. But I feel like we have to spend more time now, but I don't have any different criteria than I had before. So,
well, this will be the first year that a renewal fee is charged. So, first of all, industry is going to go bonkers anyway, because all of a sudden they're going to have to pay something. Of what we've discussed thus far, I am leaning toward a one-figure average, just so that you can say, okay, the first year is going to cost $125, regardless of how long it takes us to do your individual one. And that would allow us to get you to get some experience under your belt on whether or not this figure accurately represents what it costs you. And then you can change it. That's the nice thing about regulations. They're a lot easier to change than the code. Now I'll let you.
I just,
you're like a commission meeting.
Yeah.
It comes at the podium. You need to get sworn in.
Yeah. You know what's really great is people can hear me today. Usually they can't. Where Benny was talking and you were asking about what's happened in the past. The few, and I do mean the very few, that we have brought in front of the commission is probably, what, less than five in the last 30 years. Everyone was approved by the commission over us. So, just food for thought.
I might be out of line here, but it is the first meeting, so... I'm looking at a lot of people, a lot of knowledge at this commission that have been there a number of years. You've seen a lot of lease renewals. You've seen a lot of leases. You've seen a lot of businesses, a lot of companies, a lot of individuals. Without being, again, overly subjective, you have an idea who is a good actor and a bad actor. Bad actors are not coming to the commission. Well, unless they're coming for the wrong reason. They're not sitting on a committee, giving their time and talking about productive ways to help the industry free up ground. We all know that. So there's got to be a way, for lack of a better term, to flesh people out. So in order to cut to the chase, you're either saying every person is going to come before this commission and explain why their lease is important to them, or their leases, let's say. And the person that doesn't show up obviously has it for the wrong reason. As Mark was leaving, he said, we have people in there that are doing the right thing, propagating shellfish. It's by the code. You don't have to harvest, you have to propagate. You have to put things overboard, shell, seed. Then you have people using it for the wrong use. Well, what is that? I mean, what use are they using it for that's not propagating shellfish? I don't think they are. I think they're just holding it because they don't want to let it go. They want to either keep somebody from doing something out in front of their property, or it's been in their family for a long time. I get it. But we have to find a way to get those few bad actors out in the open, because the industry feels, I think, the majority of the industry feels that we're using leases the right way. And the only way to get them to come out and say, or not even say, but give up a lease that they're not using, and I dare to say you know who they are, that to bring them in front of the commission. I don't know exactly how we go about that, but I think we have to put them on the spot.
That's why I'm bringing up the CZM study. You know, I felt like that was the first time I'd seen some of those numbers about the number of people we had that were putting nothing on bottom.
Okay, for those people who don't know what the CZM study, can you give a
the quick shot of what you're talking about?
They talked about it in the meeting, but didn't make it available to us. What they gave us kind of the high notes, which were the percentage of ground where people were not doing anything to build up the ground, but then we're coming in a couple of, you know, waiting for 2 to 3 years of natural buildup and then scraping, was actually really high. I know that's what Mark's got in mind. I know it's why we've talked a lot about this idea of ecological services, because that does a good job of capturing the nonprofit, the restoration organizations, and our more intensive aquaculture people. But I don't think it's that much of a mystery who we're trying to target here. I think we're looking for the person that just didn't do anything on their ground and then reset the ground to zero in a couple of years. That's a one-way take, and we, I think there's broad consensus around the idea that that's not how we should be managing the Commonwealth resources. So, you know, I think that's the definition we're driving at. It's what gives Ben and Hank sufficient freedom to look at that and say, without a question, that's no. And when they come up to the commission, they're going to get backed up by the commission because there's a regulation there that gives them clear guidance on how we consider these leases. You know, we beat this thing to death for a while, and I think that was the one area we had consensus around. And I think Bo pointed out we didn't want to steal his mother's Thanksgiving oysters. I agree. I don't want to take it. She's a really nice lady. But I do want to make sure that these leases are you're putting something into it, because this is not your resource, this is Virginia's resource, and if you're giving nothing to it and you're just scraping up profit, then you shouldn't be getting rid of it. And I don't know who is that.
You have something, Becky?
Yeah, so I was going to say, in the Lynnhaven River, we have one branch that's relatively productive and then another branch that really doesn't have the capacity in most of the waterway to produce any oysters. And yet, time over time, these have been renewed and there's not been any production at all within them. So the reasons that people hold them are as varied as the number of people who hold them. I mean, I think everybody has their own reason for why they hold on to them. Some of them are not even local, you know, they're not there, they're from Richmond or other places, and I know they're not, you know, necessarily active. It came to my mind that I checked out some library books recently and had to renew them, and they will renew them if there's nobody waiting in line, you know, regardless of whether I'm reading that book or not. It might be beneficial to, during the last year of a lease term, to change the color on your map and let anybody kind of comment to you who may have an alternate use or, you know, some, a different plan for that space or information that isn't available, not as to competing use plans, but basically just to provide you with information strictly as to whether it's in production or not. I don't want everyone to have to come before a hearing, and maybe there's, you know, kind of a buyout. But it does seem like it would be difficult for you to get statewide all the information that you're going to need just on the basis of one piece of paper, even if you expand the part at the bottom about explaining how you're using it. But I do think it needs more than just bushels. It does imply that you're looking at bushels harvested when you're looking at this form, and rather than say why you haven't produced, just say tell us how you're using it. Leave it a little more open-ended in the education concept or the rotation or, you know, other aspects of it that would be beneficial for you to know.
We can make the form better.
So now you get to read dissertations on why their niche should be renewed. I like the idea, quite frankly, of taking the bushels and the shells and everything else and asking, how have you used this ground beneficially, period. And that will take care of Bev's education, it will take care of Russ's environmental services.
And I get those now. Sometimes I get C is next sheet.
Oh,
on comments. Okay. And they write me a whole letter about, and a lot of times it's not a big operator, it's somebody that has a lease or two. They want to tell me every little thing they've done, you know, Shell, this and that, the grandkids come. I mean, I read them.
What's to say that's not a beneficial use?
Right.
So maybe we're looking at this thing as the elephant. We're trying to eat this elephant when really we should start at the bottom. And clearly, if a renewal comes in and there's nothing, and we start there and say, okay, you didn't do anything, you're not getting renewed, and if you have a problem with that, you go before the commission. And then we maybe can build from there. Instead of trying to put parameters on every beneficial use, just start with the people who've done nothing. Just nothing.
And the fee isn't going to scare people away. I mean, it's $100 to $300, whatever we're talking about, over 10 years. My point with the industry was if you have multiple leases coming up at the same time, $300 times 10 of them, you know, I think that's more significant. However, I don't think somebody's going to look at it that might live in, you know, off the Chesapeake Bay or Roanoke or something and say, I got some leases over there, but I don't really do anything with them. But I mean, I want them in the family and things. I mean, $100 to $300 is going to deter them over 10 years, I don't think. Not like the application fee, where I think we really did some good work there in raising that significantly and the transfer and so on. It's a little bit different.
And I want to address Becky's comment a little bit. So a number of the leases, and we know the names, she and I know the names of the people who had these leases in Virginia Beach, they circumvented the renewal form more often by not by transferring the lease or adding another person to the lease. This change in the law now will definitely help us. But it's just like the 10-year renewal. It now says we have discretion on whether to transfer a lease or not. It clearly says you can't do it to circumvent, but it says you have to have been denied already for your 10-year renewal. But it also gives us latitude to look at 1205, other uses, and that's why my transfer form has the questions you've seen on it. The first set of questions is for the current leaseholder. Tell me what you did, kind of like the 10-year renewal. And then the bottom questions are for the new guy that's getting it. Give me a plan of what you're planning to do. If neither one of them look like they cut the mustard, I think we now have the authority not to transfer the lease, which is like not renewing it, except they will get to keep it. You know, and it'd be a wake-up call. If they're in their seventh year and they can't show me during 7 years they've done anything or virtually nothing, and now they want to transfer it, maybe just to circumvent the law, maybe they legitimately want to transfer it to somebody, we'll have the discretion to say, the new guy better have a really good plan because the old guy just didn't cut it at all. And then we'll transfer it. Otherwise, no. And we can't take the lease. The law doesn't allow us to take it right then when they're trying to transfer it. But then they got 3 years. They better go gangbusters the next 3 years if they want to come back and transfer it or keep it. So we do have a new tool with the law. It'll take time in Virginia Beach for it to play out because these people may attempt to do this again when their 10 years is up. This is, well, we'll just transfer it to another family member, right? But we'll say, okay, what have you done? It's been polluted the whole time. They could say beneficial use. Well, I put a lot of Shell on it, and if they legitimately did, hey, they're helping to clean the water. Maybe it'll open up, but most of them won't be able to do that. They won't be able to show me to know that.
I think the comment was made by Delegate Bloxa, maybe in the work group, but he, and I think he was talking about his own leases, but he had a handful of leases, some of which were, as we've talked about, seed areas or transplant areas. He'd grow them up to an inch and then move them to somewhere to get them to 2-3 inches market size, and then harvest some of that so his records would only be for this lease. And I think he was the one that brought up the idea of renewals in the context of you renew one of my leases is productive, you renew all the leases. That's like kind of a package or a company idea. And that may be fine for some of those scenarios, but that doesn't really, I don't think, work overall as a solution. But I guess going back to we have maybe a few individuals that are doing the wrong thing with
with a lease. Is it possible, and this is thinking outside of the box here, that you have businesses that are renewing leases and working and propagating shellfish and, you know, all those things, and you'd look at their renewal come up 10 years, okay? You qualify for a renewal, and you get a 20-year lease. And you come up with somebody, as Kim indicated, that hasn't done a thing. We're going to renew your lease. It's going to be for a year, and you're going to show us year after year after year what your productivity is, or not just the productivity standard, what's your use. So now you can't, I understand you can't change the lease term, but it would be on a probationary thing. You really think this is important ground? You're showing on the bottom of your sheet that you did something else, not just productivity, you did something else. Okay, fine, we're going to give you the chance. Next year you're going to show me that you did productivity. On the flip side, the people that are doing the right thing get rewarded with a 20-year lease. Or maybe not 20 years, that might be too long to go back to the 70s, I guess. But, you know, there may be something here that you're looking at very few individuals that are doing the wrong thing. I think we addressed some with the application fee. This renewal thing could be a problem. But it would also flesh out the people that are trying to get behind this thing and transfer and put somebody else on the lease. Show us what you're doing.
Well, the current law is 10 years, and it would take some modification to the law, I think, to create some other...
Yeah, possibly. But reward the businesses that are doing the right thing and have been and propagating shellfish and doing those things, and take out the people that aren't.
Okay.
So what I think the question is this renewal fee? I go back to that. So I'm leaning sort of where Mike is now. And I'm trying to just put on my CBF conservation hat here and think about the fact that if we make additional investments in some of these tributaries over the next couple of years, we're going to be headed towards more and more bulk lease renewals, and that we're nonprofits in the name. So I like the idea of not getting slammed for the full cost, particularly if I don't think... I'm hearing from industry, and I guess I'm not hearing a compelling reason how this is going to weed people out right now. And so if I tend to think that we have to get to that through a stronger definition on beneficial use that gives you something to show the commission when you make a recommendation than this fee. So I'm a big fan of whatever your average cost is for this.
I guess I'm more of a fan of maybe something lower than an average cost. I might be leaning towards, I'm looking at the shellfish aquaculture leasing and permitting in the coastal United States forms that you gave us. And I see 15 years, duration of leases, 15 years, 15 years, 20 years. We're actually one of the small, the states that has a smaller duration, I guess, maybe right in the middle, but I agree with what Jay says, being a nonprofit, that you don't want to slam them with a large fee if they have multiple leases to renew at the same time. Same for smaller growers. And I think we're looking at a small percentage of bad actors. So I'd like not to, I'm kind of formulating my thought here, not like to penalize small growers, even large growers, renewing a large number of leases at one time. Nonprofits, making it a small fee, because I do agree that I think the transfer, what we put in place for the transfer fees, takes care of a lot of the bad actors. Again, I might be all over the place here, but I think we don't want to penalize. I think we can weed out the people that aren't doing anything. And to put a fee on nonprofits, small growers, large growers with lots of areas that are going to be renewed at once,
I would lean towards a smaller fee. And that can be increased as we look at it in years to come.
Isn't the fee in code?
Up to $300, not to exceed $300.
Yeah, so that's in code. So you can't go up over $300, but in regulation you can make it up to $300.
Yeah.
Correct.
If you were to go higher, you'd have to go back to the code.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, we're capped there. Jay?
So just hypothetically, if you came down at 100, is there a duration of time you have to wait if you decided you needed to increase that fee before bringing it back to the commission, or could it just be as soon as it dawned on you? No.
What's put in regulation? If they write it in the regulation that the fee is renewed, reevaluated every 3 years or every year, then you could specify when you could change it.
I mean, that's an option. I mean, we would, before we were to change the fee again, we would go back through the regulatory rulemaking process. We probably wouldn't just get up on a Tuesday and decide to change it. Or not.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add, I think if you establish a fee in regulation and for some reason you realize 6 months later that something was amiss, you could always revisit that. Now, if you put a time period in there to reevaluate it, then that starts to get at, you're going to aim for that time period. But I think it could be reevaluated any time if need be. I'd like to offer a couple thoughts as I sit here and listen to this, and I don't know if it's going to be worth the words, but a lot of great ideas and concepts that I don't think we had necessarily debated or thought about. We knew what some of the issues would be as we discussed what the options were. But what I have heard today is there's a few bright lines, I think, here in terms of how people use their lease and how it's documented that they use their lease. One's mandatory reporting, as Tommy put it. How you relate that to particular leases that you're using of someone else's, what kind of contract issues you have with them. That was in the details, but the bright line is someone mandatory reporting that they're using it? And all of the industry folks are doing that, whether it's on every lease every 10 years is a question. And then the other bright line is you have the commercial active participants in the industry. And I think in some way, shape, or form, you've got some pretty rigorous documentation that you're doing that. You've got a waterman's card, or the proprietor has a waterman's card, or they've got certain licenses and authorizations to conduct their business and sell seafood. Maybe in Beth's case, they've got some type of documentation from the Bureau of Education or whatever it might be to provide that educational service. And in the Day Foundation's perspective, they're a nonprofit, and they've gone into this knowing that we would acquire some space in the submerged lands of the Commonwealth to create sanctuaries. And they've done that maybe with leases or gifts of leases. I don't always know. So if somehow those bright lines could be recognized and those, when you check those boxes or you recognize you meet that sort of bright line criteria, your renewal rate is minimal. I mean, whether it's $100 or $50 or $10. But it's when you don't check off any of those bright line sort of issues that you're up at the other end. And the way Ben put this early on is when we have an application come in for renewal, the money's going to kind of come in with it as an application fee. But if you establish it saying if you meet these certain bright line criteria, your renewal rate's $50. If you don't meet any of these bright lines criteria, your rate is going to be $300. And that seems to me kind of gets that the concept of you got some folks out there who haven't done a thing. It's no way they can just the ones that are biggest problems, I wouldn't think there's much of a way to document that they meet any of those sort of bright line sort of factors. So anyway, you know, given everything you've talked about today and some of the things that we have sort of mulled over, maybe if you could give some thought to that sort of bright line criteria as to what they would be for getting in the door without paying much at all versus you got to pay a little bit.
If I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying is that that we could work on a possible form that would ask the questions about the mandatory reporting, the conservation, educational, or, you know, whatever, sanctuary type, what, those things. And at the, and to the right, they would say, I'm just making a number up, $50, and then, you know, no oyster planting or none of the above, $300. You know, I'm wondering how many people would check that box.
Yeah. But they're going to have some, like I said, if you had to report it, we know. Right. If you know it, or if you didn't, you know it. And if you're a registered waterman or you have an aquaculture license to conduct certain businesses, you know that. The people that don't have it can't check that box, so they don't have those licenses. So that's just a concept.
You have something that says attached, see documentation attached.
Are you proposing that be in the regulations, or are you proposing developing of a guideline of what you use to evaluate?
Yeah.
The problem is, if you're using it as guidance, you don't know until after it comes in how much to charge the guy.
No, well, I would get back to Jay's point about, we're talking about fees here, and so it's a regulation. It's got to be a regulation. And it's just some trip points. Either you yes or no, whether you match a reporter or you didn't, or you did some of these other things, or you have these certain licenses, you get in the door and you don't have to pay much. If you don't have any of that associated with shellfish propagation, shellfish growth, commercial production, that's when it requires, seems to me, a lot more scrutiny on our end to start sorting out what in the world did they use that lease for.
So what I'm going to propose, and I think Ben and I are on the same page, is I think what we're struggling with is sort of how many are good actors and how many are bad actors, and we don't have that many renewals that have come in since the law was enacted a month and a half ago. But we do have a bunch of renewals behind us. And so what we can look at doing is a retrospective of, with the current law and the criteria, looking back at several years of leases and trying to figure out, on our best estimate, this is the number of leases that came in with easily definable criteria. They had mandatory reporting. They had receipts for shell. They had a diagnosis of MSX or dermo. This is the number of leases that came in that we were like, under this new law, we probably would have required more. And I think that will help us define the universe of what we're talking about. You know, is it really 90% of these are actually pretty clear, or is it 50? And so that's a recommendation in terms of MRC homework before the next meeting, is to try to do that retrospective analysis to see what we're actually talking about.
More work.
Yes. I'm sorry, it is homework. I will help. But I think that will help address some of these questions of really what are we looking at.
And I think that'll be helpful in that one thing I'll know for sure if I do some review of a year, do every other month for you, I can give you the percent that didn't return the form real easy. So you'll know that. And that's pretty consistent. You know, I mean, that's pretty consistent. I can tell you that whatever that percent is, the number that got renewed, is going to be almost all of them. Because they're all going to have contacted me and said, oh, hey, you know, there's a few that I never hear from. I mean, I do terminate a couple of leases a month solely because they didn't send the form back and they never called and they stay terminated.
So as we do this analysis, I mean, we laid out some that are sort of obvious to us. I heard you, AJ, on mandatory reporting can't be the only criteria. Are there other things that you think we should look at if we're trying to do this retrospective analysis? You know, has anyone else mentioned, you know, education or sanctuary? Are there other criteria that you think we should use in our assessment?
I think that one of the things you can look at, and I don't know how hard this would be, but if somebody has multiple leases, there is a possibility that they've used this rotation that we talked about, where they've used X lease, Y lease, and Z lease, but they haven't used this one, you know, for the last year. So that would not automatically be an outlier. It would just be an indication that that was resting, or that had been seeded, or something happened, you know, not, and I think there are probably a lot of people who have multiple leases. Is that not true?
Oh, yeah, it is. I mean, we could add a question that even asked that, you know.
Is
this part of a rotational lease system? Do you do rotation on this lease itself?
I have to laugh because I'm sitting here and think about some of the reasons why we don't use a particular area. And there's one area that consistently during certain times of the year, part of, the greatest part of that lease is over 5 foot, even at mean low, and I'm 5 foot two, so I don't.
Being short is not.
I don't get it. You know what I'm saying? There's a lot of different reasons. Your mind just goes to all the reasons why people don't use all four of the leases every month. You can't. You've only got a crew of three, so you can't use all four of your leases every month.
Ethan,
of the leases, the renewals that don't respond. Of those people that don't respond to the renewal, are they generally single leaseholders or are they multiple leaseholders?
It's a mix. I just in the last 2 months had a pretty considerable leaseholder that had 12 leases. They all came up at the same time, and he didn't send any of the forms back. And I did the 30-day terminated their lease, and they called me up and said, you about gave an 80-year-old man a heart attack. And I said, well, I sent the forms, you know, 3 months ago, and he sent them in, you know. But, so it, I have a Bevins lease right now that hasn't been sent back. So I'm telling you.
Well, I'm just curious if it was single leaseholders, you'd be under the multiple leaseholders that did not respond.
It's more likely a single or a person maybe has two leases. And they don't even come up at the same time. You know, they come up at different times. And they'll call me and say, oh, you know, I thought my lease expired. And I said, no, that's your other lease. You know, you have a second one. So it's more the small or single leaseholders. But I sometimes have industry people. Yeah, that's why I brought up the 90 days, and you know, I don't know what the optimal time is to send these things out. You have to send something out. You know, you can't think it was just proactively know that 10 years ago when I got it, I realized, okay, on March 31st of 2019, you know, I got to call VMRC up. So we have to send them something. And I just feel like you get more that don't get sent back than I think is normal. If you get a bill in the mail from a credit card, it's about 30 days. You pay it. But if you get it, if you got it 3 months, would you might put it on a shelf somewhere and forget it? I think that happens. But I want to give people enough time. And I think what Russ said is, you know, if we're going to try to back it off so that we don't terminate leases on the day because we didn't send it back, or we got it right at the end, you know, yeah, say the deadline is 30 days in advance. I don't think there's anything in the code that restricts us from that. And then we don't terminate it. But we start doing something in that last 30 or 60 days to say we didn't get it or it's not enough.
But you're not terminating them anyways, right? You're sending a letter that says your lease is terminated. It's really not terminated.
Right.
Is that right?
I mean, it's still in the system. It's just tagged. It gets a new status. Did not reply. That's what it says. And then, if they send it in and it's not adequate, the same thing happens. There's a letter that says didn't meet the qualifications. They still get a letter that says terminated. But last time they call, even ones that people would send them back and put something on it and say, well, I put something down. I said, well, you know, this is, it doesn't cut the mustard. I'm sorry. You know, 2 bushels harvested and no shell over 10 years. Oh, well, I did more than that. And they'll send me another form with more information on it. You know, I don't want to call them a liar, but I don't have the manpower to go out and check, you know, that, oh, well, I really did plant 100 bushels every year or shell. You know, it's a 3-acre lease. Well,
and by law, you can't ask them to appear before the commission?
Well, I mean, I can terminate the lease, and then they can ask to come on the commission. And Hank's right. The only ones we've ever terminated that came back, at least the people don't come in. I never hear from them.
And my guess is you've been one of the commissioners that approved one.
And I mean, on that note, it may help. I mean, this, again, this new law, this new era of this, it may help give the commission more clear guidelines or regulations, so the commission has something more to hang their hat on in terms of, well, my staff recommended this not be renewed because of X, Y, and Z. I think that's also what the law offers, and that's when Hank made that very important point. I think we need to think about, at the end of the day, when they request a hearing, it's 9 commissioners that are making that decision. How can we inform and empower those commissioners on some of these issues? Any other thoughts or questions? We're closing in on 2 hours. Really appreciate everybody's help and insight today in this. I think it gives us some good things to go think on. The intent of this committee, particularly in the beginning, was to try to meet monthly because we do have a large list of things to get done. And as we found today, there are going to be some thorny issues. So my recommendation is that we meet the second Monday of the month, which would be May 13th. I'm going to propose I send out an email to everybody, and that way you can have a chance to look at your schedules and we can circle back on that. So no one has to commit right now. But sort of moving forward, I think if we can get a standing date on the calendar, it'll be a little bit easier for scheduling purposes. So thank you again very much for your time and for your comments. Much appreciated.
Well, if you think of something, email in between. Questions, something you need to provide.
Thank you.